The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading from the October 13th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The drawing on the cover this week shows a tattered American flag against a gray sky in the background. And the flag is riddled with bullet holes, many, many bullet holes. And the title is The Killing Field. Is the U.S. powerless to stop mass shootings? And we'll take that as our main story. The massacre in Las Vegas. What happened? The nation was left reeling this week by the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history after a gunman on the 32nd floor of a Las Vegas hotel shot dead 58 people and injured 527 others at a country music festival across the street below. The massacre began at 10:07 p.m. on Sunday night when 64-year-old retiree Stephen Paddock smashed out two windows in his suite at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino and began raining down bullets on the 22,000 festival goers. Using semi-automatic rifles fitted with bump stock accessories, which increased the rate of fire to nearly machine gun levels, Paddock spent 11 minutes spraying the crowd with bullets as they dove, hid, and ran for cover. "I stepped over a guy with blood pouring out of his head," said Craig Herman, 57, a survivor. "I saw maybe 15 others like that. I've never seen so much blood." When a SWAT team stormed Paddock's suite, they found Paddock dead from self-inflicted pistol wound. He had an arsenal of 23 guns, 12 fitted with bump stocks, and had set up three remote cameras to watch for police. Investigators said they were baffled over what motivated Paddock. A retired real estate investor who lived in Mesquite, Nevada, he often traveled to Las Vegas to gamble large sums on video poker. He had no criminal record, though his father was a bank robber who was once on the FBI's most wanted list, and seems to have bought his weapons legally. Paddock has no ties to international terror groups and was described by family and neighbors as a loner with no obvious political or religious views. Police were hoping to learn more from his Filipino girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley, who left the country 2 weeks before the attack but returned to the U.S. on Tuesday. President Donald Trump, who called the shooting an act of pure evil, traveled to Las Vegas to meet survivors and first responders. Amid calls from Democrats for stricter gun laws, the president said he was open to a discussion on that topic at some point, perhaps. What the editorial said. "The massacre in Las Vegas was horrifying," said NationalReview.com. "The reaction to it, dispiriting. Progressives made the usual calls for commonsensical gun control measures, none of which would have helped in Las Vegas. Paddock would have passed any background check. The sobering fact is that mass murders have become an ordinary part of our cultural landscape. And unless we want to seize all guns and convert our country into a police state, we will remain vulnerable to acts of mass violence." Four of the nation's deadliest mass shootings, Virginia Tech, Newtown, Orlando, and now Las Vegas, have now occurred in the past decade, said USA Today. After every one, the gun lobby insists various gun control measures would not have stopped that particular shooting. But that's not the point. In countries such as Australia and Britain, mass shootings prompted legislative action that significantly reduced firearm deaths. In the U.S., the Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms, but allows for reasonable regulation. We could limit future carnage by adopting universal background checks on buyers and banning the kinds of assault weapons, bump stocks, and high-capacity magazines Paddock used to turn Las Vegas into a killing field. What the columnist said. Stephen Paddock is a frightening enigma, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Though solitary and itinerant, he was relatively wealthy, relatively old, and apparently unaffiliated with any extremist groups. He fits into none of the obvious mass shooter profiles. If an apparently, quote, ordinary guy is capable of an act this monstrous, what hope can there be to identify suspects like him before they attack? If Paddock had been a Muslim, then Trump, Congress, and many Americans would be in full panic mode and demanding drastic action, said Adam Gopnik in NewYorker.com. But because he was just one more American psycho with an arsenal of killing machines, Republicans disingenuously insist there's nothing at all to be done. Sorry, but the fact that we are still overreacting to Muslims because of 9/11 doesn't mean we should also overreact to mass shootings, said Nick Gillespie in Reason.com. If gun control is the answer, why did firearms crime and homicide rates drop significantly between 1993 and 2015, a period when it became much easier to acquire guns in most states? This idea that gun control doesn't work is a pernicious lie, said Democratic Senator Chris Murphy in the Washington Post. Since my state of Connecticut responded to the Newtown massacre of 20 schoolchildren by expanding background checks and requiring issued handgun permits, gun crimes have dropped by 40%. The debate over gun control runs much deeper than policy specifics, said Ann Helen Peterson in BuzzFeed.com. Liberals intrinsically believe it is the responsibility of the group to protect individuals, even if that entails individual sacrifices. Conservatives think everyone has the right to make decisions for themselves, and that the sacrifices liberals propose are simply not worth the compromise of their liberty. With each mass shooting, these oppositional philosophies harden. Controversy of the week, gerrymandering. Should the Supreme Court intervene? Donald Trump was right, said the New York Times in an editorial. America's political system is rigged. One primary way the rigging is accomplished is through partisan gerrymandering, the practice of redrawing electoral districts to favor one political party over the other. This week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a landmark gerrymandering case that could transform the American landscape. The case of Gill versus Whitford concerns Wisconsin, whose GOP-controlled legislature redrew boundaries with such blatant partisanship that even though Democrats won 51% of statewide votes in 2012, Republicans took 60 of 99 seats in the state assembly. And Wisconsin is no aberration. Nationally, recent Republican gerrymandering helps explain why the GOP holds 10% more House seats than the Democrats, 241 to 194, despite winning only 1% more of the congressional vote in 2016. The Supreme Court has historically shied away from gerrymandering cases, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com, for fear of being accused of meddling in politics. A newly developed statistic called the efficiency gap, however, precisely measures the effect of redistricting on parties' relative power in a state. In an oral argument this week, perennial swing vote Anthony Kennedy seemed receptive to using the efficiency gap as a tool in such cases. If he upholds a lower court ruling that Wisconsin's redistricting violates the Constitution's one-person, one-vote principle, it would be a game-changing decision. The Democrats' problem isn't gerrymandering, said Guy Harrison and Jason Torchinsky in NationalReview.com, which both parties practice with relish when in power. Their real problem is that their voters are now clustered into coastal states and large urban areas. That gives them lopsided victories in relatively few districts, but few voters in the many districts encompassing large rural areas that lean Republican. Unable to woo rural voters with their policies, Democrats are now essentially asking the Supreme Court to undo natural self-sorting. District-based representation is a bedrock principle of American politics, said John Ryder in the Wall Street Journal, replacing it with what Chief Justice John Roberts this week called sociological gobbledygook about fairness is a line the high court shouldn't cross. Crossing that line would lead to unending litigation, said George Will in the Washington Post. Drawing electoral districts has been a partisan process since the beginning of our republic. If courts intervene on the basis of an efficiency gap, both parties will summon dueling professors who will cherry-pick concocted metrics to insist various districts are unfair. That's why Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter warned in a 1946 gerrymandering case that the court should not enter this political thicket. The court's historical reluctance to tackle the issue is understandable, said Edwin Karaminski in the Sacramento Bee. But sophisticated computer programs have made gerrymandering more powerful than ever. And when a minority of voters consistently wins a majority of seats, it leaves voters cynical about the political process. In the Wisconsin case, a federal court ruled that the efficiency gap, which measures how many votes were wasted in districts a party didn't win, provides a reliable measure of how districts were drawn. When a state cannot explain a major gap by natural geography or population patterns, the court ruled, it's fair to conclude that the districts were drawn unconstitutionally. If we're to avoid a true crisis in our democracy, we urgently need to get back to a system where voters choose their elected officials rather than elected officials choosing their voters. Time for our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for reality. After two quantum physicists published a study disputing the fashionable notion that we're living in a computer simulation like the Matrix. To generate the complex behavior of subatomic particles, the physicists argue, a supercomputer would require more atoms than exist in the universe. It was a good week for self-reliance after an Italian fitness instructor became so frustrated with the dating game that she married herself in a lavish ceremony. Laura Messi, 40, spent $12,000 to stage my fairy tale wedding, only without a Prince Charming. It was a good week for ceasing and desisting after Pablo Escobar's family demanded $1 billion from Netflix, whose hit show Narcos is based on the life of the late drug kingpin. If we don't receive it, said Escobar's brother Roberto, we will close their little show. But it was a bad week for human dignity after excited male visitors so badly molested a realistic new sex robot at an electronics festival in Austria that she needed extensive repairs. People can be bad, said inventor Sergei Santos. They treated the doll like barbarians. It was a bad week for Theresa May after the British Prime Minister suffered a prolonged coughing fit during a speech, then saw the F and E fall off a backdrop that read, "Building a country that works for everyone." And it was a bad week for pride after an alleged dark web drug mogul from France, Gal Valerius, was arrested en route to displaying his long red whiskers at a beard competition in Texas. I don't know anything about what other stuff he did, said beard champion MJ Johnson, but as far as his beard goes, it's really awesome. The title of our briefing page article is The Next Korean War. With tensions running high, what would a military confrontation with Kim Jong-un's North Korea actually involve? Is a limited war possible? Probably not. Trump administration officials recently said they were working on four or five military options that would not involve the total destruction of North Korea. One such option might be an air or drone decapitation strike to take out Kim himself. But assassinating the Hermit Kingdom's paranoid dictator would be extremely difficult. To avoid just such a strike, he reportedly has 30 residences, each with its own underground bunker, takes elaborate precautions to hide his location, and moves around only at night. All other military scenarios would lead to a catastrophic number of casualties, according to war games staged by the Pentagon and various think tanks. Kim has one of the world's largest artillery arsenals and would likely respond to any attack by unleashing a blistering retaliatory assault on Seoul's 10 million people, killing up to 100,000 residents in a day. The region could then spiral into an all-out months-long war costing $1 trillion in damage and million lives, according to one Pentagon estimate. It would probably be the worst kind of fighting in most people's lifetimes, Defense Secretary James Mattis has said. How would a hot war begin? If either Kim or Trump administration misread each other's belligerent rhetoric or aggressive actions as a signal of imminent attack, it could trigger the other to launch a preemptive strike. But many of North Korea's nuclear devices are hidden in the mountains or buried deep underground, and it would take the U.S. 4 or 5 days to destroy even Kim's conventional artillery, according to the Nautilus Institute, a think tank. The megalomaniacal tyrant would likely go into use or lose mode and try to inflict as much damage on his enemies as possible while he still had weapons. Even if he didn't launch some of his 20 or so nuclear warheads, Kim would still have some 8,000 conventional rocket launchers and artillery cannons dug into the mountains on his side of the demilitarized zone, the DMZ. They include 240-millimeter and 300-millimeter rocket launchers that can reach Seoul, located just 25 miles from the border. Some of these shells could be loaded with nerve gas or other chemical weapons. And if they start plopping down in the middle of the city, said Joseph Bermudez, an analyst for the U.S.-Korea Institute, there would be panic like you would not believe. What then? As Seoul's residents raced to the city's 3,300 bomb shelters, the full might of the U.S.-South Korean war machine would spring into action. The U.S.-South Korean command would direct dozens of jets and Tomahawk missiles into the north to destroy military bases and Pyongyang's major command and control infrastructure, though military experts say it would take at least 4 days to achieve this objective. If the U.S. also wanted regime change, a ground war would then begin. Former National Security Council staffer Victor Cha believes the Pentagon would deploy combat divisions of up to 120,000 troops to supplement the 28,500 U.S. soldiers already in South Korea, as well as South Korea's 650,000 active duty troops. But those combined forces would still be outnumbered by Kim's million-man army, and the ensuing battle conditions would be unforgiving, said Cha. Over 2 million mechanized forces, all converging on a total battle space, the equivalent of the distance between Washington, D.C. and Boston. What else could Kim do? Some 100,000 highly trained special operations troops could infiltrate the South via underground tunnels, many submarines, and biplanes to wreak havoc, detonating dirty bombs, assassinating government officials, and sabotaging water plants. If he began to fear for his regime's survival, Kim could start aiming his medium to long-range missiles at Japan, the U.S. territory of Guam, and even the continental U.S. itself. His last resort would be to go nuclear, knowing it would prompt the immediate destruction of his own country in a devastating U.S. nuclear counterattack. Whatever happens, Pyongyang would ultimately lose, but not without first causing mass destruction and death. And after the fighting ended, if Kim's regime collapsed, a vast wave of North Korea's 25 million poverty-stricken and malnourished people would try to flee the country for food and safety. Some might head south, but many would cross into neighboring China. This is the scenario that Beijing most dreads, and China might send its military to create a 50-mile-wide buffer zone to hold desperate North Korean citizens. The United Nations Blue Helmet peacekeeping forces would likely intervene to restore some stability amid general panic and anarchy. It could be the mother of all humanitarian relief operations, said former Army Special Forces Colonel David Maxwell. Meanwhile, U.S. forces would race to gain control over the regime's nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, and try to prevent another dictatorial regime from rising. A 2013 RAND Corporation study warned that U.S. troops crossing into the north might trigger a military confrontation with China. If we intervene and the Chinese run into our people, and if we run into their people, what are we going to do? Asked study author Bruce Bennett. All of that needs to be really thought about seriously. And we'll pick up a few of the best columns. The first comes from Jeffrey Toobin at The New Yorker. And it's titled, Gorsuch May Outdo Scalia. Neil Gorsuch is turning out to be the justice his sponsors had hoped and his opponents had feared he'd be, said Jeffrey Toobin. The conservative whom President Trump nominated to fill Antonin Scalia's Supreme Court seat has already left no doubt where he will line up on nearly every legal debate. Gorsuch last week chose to give a speech before the Fund for American Studies, a conservative advocacy group, at Trump International Hotel in Washington, which is the focus of several pending lawsuits that may wind up before the Supreme Court. He then traveled to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's hometown of Louisville to give another speech that many saw as a victory lap. McConnell, of course, made Gorsuch's nomination to the High Court possible by blocking President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. In his first 15 cases on the court, Gorsuch joined Clarence Thomas, the most right-wing justice, every time. He also reportedly irked his senior colleagues by dominating oral arguments and by expressing ill-disguised contempt for liberal justices in his opinions. Conservatives wanted a new Scalia, and in Gorsuch, they have that true ideological warrior. From the United Kingdom, why Brits now lean to the left. Socialism has turned out to be this year's surprise hit, said Fraser Nelson. Ever since Jeremy Corbyn was selected leader of the opposition Labour Party 2 years ago, members of the ruling Conservative Party have treated the Palestinian-hugging, nuke-hating far-left politician as a historical burp, a blast of foul air from the 70s creating a temporary stink in Westminster. But Corbyn has not gone away, and his fringy Marxist ideas are now widely accepted as reasonable. New research by a right-leaning think tank has revealed that three-quarters of voters strongly back Corbyn's plans to nationalize the UK's water, gas, and electricity companies. Even among supposedly free-market-cheering conservatives, two-thirds support renationalizing the railways. Half the country would be thrilled to have the state take over the banks, something even Corbyn hasn't proposed. So if anything, he's to the right of the mainstream these days. Voters too young to have seen images of Soviet breadlines have found themselves priced out of home ownership and want the government to do something. Capitalism is proving unpopular among those with no capital. And so the conservatives are now trying to appease voters by adopting labor policies. That's a losing strategy. The party must make the moral case for small government and lower taxes or risk ceding Britain to socialism. And this from Venezuela. Maduro has reduced us to beggars. It's heartbreaking to see middle-class Venezuelans begging for food, said Carolina Jaime Branger. I went to the grocery last week for the first time in nearly a month, and the entire experience was an agony. Of course, there was no cornmeal, no flour, no milk, no coffee. Still, there were supplies to be had at outrageous cost. Hyperinflation has sent prices soaring. A bottle of wine marked 25,000 bolivars, about $2,450, a few weeks ago, now cost five times as much. Even if I could afford it, how could I justify spending such a sum where there are people rooting through dumpsters outside for food? President Nicolas Maduro blames the crisis on the supposed economic war the U.S. is waging against us. But we all know that exists only in his feverish imagination. There is no Cuban-style blockade here preventing goods from entering our oil-rich country. Only sanctions against individual members of Maduro's administration. As I was about to leave the market, I was approached by a well-dressed, polite, but very thin gentleman holding a pack of bread and cheese. "I'm very sorry, ma'am," he said, "but I need help paying for these." I was overwhelmed with sympathy for him and with fury at the government that let this happen. No one in Venezuela should go hungry. Our last word article this week takes a more personal look at the tragic shooting in Las Vegas. It's titled Portraits of the Lives Lost. They came to Las Vegas from all over the country, Tennessee, California, Alaska, for 3 days of celebration and country music. Here are the stories of a handful of the dozens of people who perished. Adrian Murfitt, 35, had been working 16-hour days all summer as a commercial salmon fisherman in his home state of Alaska. It was time for a break. He gathered up two of his childhood friends and booked tickets for a country music festival, just as he had done last year, according to his sister, Shannon Goddard. He had such a great time when he went before, and he wanted to treat himself for a successful fishing season, Goddard said from Anchorage. Murfitt was an Alaskan to the core. Since he was a toddler, he loved playing hockey, she said. He could fix almost anything mechanical. He was devoted to his dog, Paxson, a West Siberian Laika. Goddard said the family had pieced together her brother's last minutes from Brian McKinnon, a friend who was with him at the concert Sunday night. He was just having a good time, enjoying himself, and got shot in the neck, she said of her brother. A woman standing next to Murfitt was shot in the head, McKinnon told the family. He watched as medics tried to resuscitate Murfitt, though the medics told McKinnon to leave the scene for his own safety. Sadly, he died in my arms, McKinnon wrote on Facebook. I don't really know what else to say at this time. I'm really sorry. Sonny Melton. When Sonny Melton and his wife, Heather Gulish Melton, heard the sound of gunshots in Las Vegas on Sunday night, he grabbed her and began to run. I felt him get shot in the back, Gulish Melton told WCYB, a television station in northeast Tennessee. I want everyone to know what a kind-hearted, loving man he was. But at this point, I can barely breathe. Melton, 29, was described in Facebook tributes as a kind spirit, a registered nurse who worked for much of 2016 in the surgical unit at Jackson-Madison County General Hospital in Jackson, Tennessee. He was a very kind, compassionate, genuine person who lived life to the fullest, and he took great care of our patients, said Amy Garner, a spokeswoman for the hospital. Union University, a college in Jackson, said Melton was a 2015 graduate of the school and worked in the emergency department at Henry County Medical Center. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Melton and his wife had been married only a year and had traveled from Tennessee for the music festival. When the bullets began raining down from above, Sonny shielded her from danger, selflessly giving up his life to save hers, Sanders said Monday. Angie Gomez, 20, traveled from Southern California to the concert with her high school sweetheart to toast a new job as a certified nursing assistant, family friend Tyler Smith confirmed. She was just celebrating the music she loved, Smith said. She was a light to everyone in her life. She was just the best kind of person. She was what the world needs. Gomez graduated from Riverside Polytechnic High School in Riverside, California in 2015, the school confirmed on Facebook. A member of the school's cheer and song team, Gomez was remembered by her squad on Facebook as having a warm heart and a loving spirit. In a statement to the news media, the Riverside Unified School District described Gomez as always seen with a smile on her face whenever she was on campus. She was enrolled at Riverside Community College. Gomez's mother, when reached Monday afternoon, was on her way back to Riverside from Las Vegas. She was too distraught to talk and said she and her family needed time to grieve. Gomez was shot 3 times, Smith said, once in the shoulder, twice in the arm. Her boyfriend of 5 years tried to carry her out of the concert venue with the help of several strangers. But Smith said the crowds and blocked-off streets made it impossible to get Gomez to a hospital in time to save her life. She had a lot going for her, young and in love with a good family, Smith said. It's just incredibly surreal. Jordan McAldoon. Jordan McAldoon, a 23-year-old mechanic from Maple Ridge, British Columbia, was among the dead, a family member said. His parents described him to CBS News in Canada as outdoorsy, about to begin trade school, and on the trip to Las Vegas with his girlfriend. They were expecting him to return home Monday evening. "We only have one child," they told CBC News. "We just don't know what to do." Lisa Romero Muniz. Last year, Lisa Romero Muniz's husband, Chris, forgot their wedding anniversary. This year, he was determined to make it up to her. So he made a grand gesture, planning a 4-day weekend in Las Vegas and buying tickets to see her favorite country singer, Jason Aldean. Muniz, who worked long hours at a refinery, and Romero Muniz, a high school secretary in Gallup, New Mexico, left Thursday for Las Vegas, more than a 6-hour drive away. "She was beyond excited," said Rosie Fernandez, her friend and supervisor at the high school where they worked. "For her husband to remember her anniversary and do all of that, this was a big thing for her." Born and raised in the small city of Gallup, the 48-year-old was a mother of 3 grown children and a secretary at Miyamura High School, where she was responsible for disciplining students who got into trouble. Romero Muniz had a warm personality and a big laugh and was always teasing her coworkers, Fernandez said. "We were known as the 2 loudmouths of the office," Fernandez said. "She knew 90% of the kids at this school. She would talk to them like she was talking to her own children. I'd hear her saying, 'I know you can do better than this.'" John Phippen. John Phippen, 57, was a lumberjack kind of guy who loved music, said his best friend. "Still, it came as a surprise when the general contractor belted out Shania Twain's 'Man, I Feel Like a Woman' while helping the friend renovate his bathroom. It was so wrong, it was funny," said the friend Thomas Palucky, a chiropractor who lives in the same Southern California town in the Santa Clarita Valley as Phippen. Phippen attended the festival with his son, Travis. Jake Diaz, 19, who was with his mother, is a friend of the Phippens, said family members told them that Phippens jumped on top of his son when the shooting started. "He saved his life," Diaz said. Perlucky said Travis worked as a medic and, even after being shot in the arm, treated more than a dozen of the injured. Perlucky said Phippen actually looks like a teddy bear and acts like a sweetheart with a calm demeanor no matter how tense the situation. Phippen took buggies out on the sand dunes and ran a company called JP Specialties that advertises as an all-purpose remodeling company with painting, electrical, drywall, plumbing, and flooring. Perlucky said that he first met Phippen about 10 years ago after he had bought a money pit of a house. He said Phippen helped him out. "He was the guy you wanted to have a beer with," the chiropractor said. "You wouldn't want to hang out with a celebrity or politician. You'd want to hang out with John." Quentin Robbins. When Quentin Robbins, 20, first clutched his chest, his girlfriend thought something was wrong with his sugar levels, she told his grandmother. They were on a date at a Jason Aldean concert. They hadn't been together for long, but she knew he had diabetes and thought he might need his insulin. She didn't yet realize that a bullet had torn through his body. Robin's grandmother, Gaynor Wells, said Monday that he will be remembered as just a jewel. She recounted the story of his death as she heard it through his girlfriend, who was uninjured. He was the oldest of three children, a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and a student at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, where he was considering going to dental school. An avid athlete, Robin spent his time refereeing various recreation leagues in his hometown of Henderson, Nevada. He enjoyed hunting, fishing, and country music, which is why he decided to drive to Las Vegas for the Sunday night concert. His girlfriend would later tell his family about two strangers who described themselves as a Marine and a nurse who tried to carry Robbins to a vehicle so he could get medical attention, even as the gunman was still firing on the crowd. It would be hours before his family would find out for sure where he had been taken and that he hadn't survived. Sandy Casey. In early April, on the last day of their 10-day vacation in New Zealand, Christopher Willems and his girlfriend, Sandy Casey, walked down a steep hill to a lake. As she played by the water's edge, Willems took a ring out of his pocket. When she turned around, he was down on one knee. At the end of this month, they planned to tour the final wedding venue on their list. Instead, after 7 years as colleagues at Manhattan Beach Middle School in California, 3 years as a couple, and 5 months engaged, Willems held Casey, 35, on Sunday night as she died of a gunshot to her lower back. Willems, 32, worked as a behavioral therapist in Casey's special education classes. They bonded over their love of country music. They were attending the festival with a few of Willems' friends, huddled in front of the stage when the gunshots rang out. They all dropped to the ground, but Casey said she'd been hit and couldn't feel her legs. Willems stuck his finger in the wound to stop the bleeding, and then he carried her out, dodging the continuous gunfire. When she stopped responding, he told her that he loved her and that she was amazing. She was just a kind soul, and she was full of life and loved to live it, Willems said. She made everybody smile. She was an excellent teacher and loved the kids she taught. Everyone who meets her never forgets her. Casey, who also loved yoga and the outdoors, was originally from Vermont, where her family still lives. Willems says he's arranging to get her body back to her parents. She wanted to be cremated, he said, so he'll be able to keep a part of her with him. These were excerpted from articles that originally appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times. On the Health and Science page now, the lead article says, nerve stimulation restores partial consciousness. Using a new experimental treatment, neurosurgeons in France have enabled a patient who had been in a vegetative state for more than 15 years to smile, cry, and show other signs of consciousness. The 35-year-old man had been in unresponsive wakefulness, periodically opening his eyes but never awake or responding to his surroundings, since suffering brain damage in a car accident in 2001, reports NewScientist.com. A team from the French National Center for Scientific Research wrapped electrodes around the patient's vagus nerve, which extends from the brain stem to the abdomen. When they stimulated this nerve with tiny electrical currents, the patient experienced increased brain activity. After just 1 month of treatment, he opened his eyes more often, tracked people moving around his room, and responded to requests to turn his head. He even shed tears on hearing his favorite song. While the severity of his brain damage makes it very unlikely he'll ever regain the ability to talk or walk, the nerve stimulation appears to have taken him out of a vegetative state. Study leader Angela Sirigu says more research is needed into the treatment, which is already used for some forms of epilepsy and depression. But she says the findings show that the brain repair is still possible even when hope seems to have vanished. Another iceberg breakaway. An iceberg four times the size of Manhattan broke away from a glacier in western Antarctica last month, permanently altering the continent's coastline and increasing concerns about rising sea levels. The 100-square-mile chunk of ice calved from the Pine Island Glacier, which accounts for about 45 billion tons of ice flow into the ocean each year. Scientists monitoring the glacier via satellite say the newly formed iceberg is unstable and has already broken apart into smaller pieces as it drifts out to sea. Though massive, the berg is dwarfed by the Delaware-sized block of ice that split from the Larsen Sea ice shelf in Antarctica earlier this year, reports CBSNews.com. The new breakaway won't directly affect global sea levels because that portion of Pine Island is already floating. But it may diminish the glacier's function as a plug that holds back ice streams from the West Antarctic ice shelf. Scientists are also concerned that these calving events are becoming more frequent and that they're forming in the center of the glacier as warmer ocean water weakens it from below. If new rifts continue to form progressively inland, says Ian Howitt, a glaciologist at Ohio State University, the significance to the ice shelf retreat would be high. We're on the Talking Points page. We'll start with tax reform. Who would benefit from Trump's plan? President Trump's tax plan represents the most pro-growth fiscal agenda since Ronald Reagan unleashed the economy in the 1980s, says Charles Gasparino in the New York Post. Under the initial blueprint announced last week, the number of tax brackets would collapse from 7 to 3, simplifying our messy tax system, while the top individual tax rate would drop from 39.6% to 35%. The bottom rate would rise slightly from 10% to 12%, but lower to middle income folks would see their standard deduction double to $12,000 for individuals and $24,000 for married couples, and enjoy an as-yet-unspecified increase in the child tax credit. Trump's plan also contains a mountain of incentives for small and large businesses, said Larry Kudlow in NationalReview.com. It cuts the corporate tax rate from 35%, one of the highest rates in the world, to a much more competitive 20%, encouraging U.S. companies to expand and hire more workers. This is a revolutionary change, said Trump, and the biggest winners will be the American workers. Unfortunately, none of that is true, said David Lennart in the New York Times. Trump insists that his plan favors middle-income Americans and not the rich. But an analysis by the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center found that about 30% of taxpayers earning between $50,000 and $150,000 would see their taxes increase under the GOP plan. Meanwhile, by 2027, 80% of the plan's benefits would go to the wealthiest 1%. Republicans howl about the national debt when a Democrat is president, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. but don't seem to care that their plan would explode the deficit by reducing federal revenues by $2.4 trillion over a decade. The GOP hopes to claw back about $1 trillion by closing loopholes and tax breaks, including eliminating the deduction for state and local taxes. But every existing deduction will be vigorously defended by its beneficiaries and lobbyists. Republicans could avoid their math problem by not giving a tiny number of extremely affluent people a big tax cut in the first place. But that's the motivation of the entire exercise. Trump's critics must be clairvoyant, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. They've denounced his tax plan even before crucial details are known. And the Tax Policy Center's analysis doesn't even attempt to factor in the growth impact from tax cuts. After years of stagnation under Obama, Trump's plan could encourage at least 3% growth, adding some $2.5 trillion to the Treasury. Actually, that's a long disproven Republican myth, said Catherine Rample in the Washington Post. Recent history shows no evidence that tax cuts create so much economic growth they pay for themselves. When Kansas passed sweeping tax cuts in 2012, it experienced below-average growth, huge budget shortfalls, and brutal cuts to school funding and social services. Eventually, after realizing their supply-side experiment had failed, red-faced Republicans were forced to raise taxes again. Trump is peddling another outright lie, said Seth Hanlon in Fortune.com. The president claims he and other wealthy people wouldn't personally benefit from his tax plan, when, in fact, he and his billionaire-filled cabinet will enjoy a huge windfall if it passes Congress. His proposal eliminates the estate tax, which applies only to the 1 in 500 U.S. families whose assets are worth more than $5.5 million, saving Trump and his family an estimated $1.1 billion. It also creates a special preferential 25% pass-through tax for partnerships and limited liability companies. Trump owns more than 500 such companies. And it eliminates the alternative minimum tax, essentially the sole reason Trump paid any tax on his $150 million income in the 2005 return that was partly leaked to the press. Trump doesn't just benefit from his tax plan, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. He flourishes under it. That's if Republicans manage to pass the tax plan, said Adam Brandon in WashingtonExaminer.com. Already their backs are up against the wall. Blue state Republicans are threatening no votes if GOP leaders go through with eliminating deductions for state and local taxes. A change that would hurt taxpayers from high-tax states such as California and New York. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee says he won't back any plan that adds one penny to the deficit. But failing to pass something isn't an option. The GOP has already botched Obamacare repeal, despite controlling Congress and the White House. The 2018 midterms are creeping ever closer. If Republicans don't pass tax reform, they're screwed. Hefner, his impact on sexual mores. The conventional wisdom on Playboy founder Hugh Hefner is that he was a retrograde chauvinist, said Carrie Pizzullo in Politico.com, a creepy old man who created a sexist, objectifying rag. The truth is more complicated. Before Playboy hit the newsstands in 1953, society recognized only two types of women: good girls who married young as virgins and had sex in order to bear children, and bad girls who had sex before marriage and enjoyed it. With his Playmate centerfolds, Hefner rejected this constrained vision of women's sexuality and showed that good girls enjoyed sex too, that women were as sexual as men. In the conservative post-war years, that was a revolutionary idea. For all his faults, Hefner fought for sexual liberation his whole career, said Erin Gloria Ryan in thedailybeast.com. He pushed for women's access to birth control and vigorously supported legalizing abortion long before Roe v. Wade. He stood up for gay rights when most others didn't dare. You have to hand it to Hef, spinning his commodification of female flesh as a win for sexual liberation, said Christine Catarucci in Slate.com. He was obviously right that women enjoy sex and should be allowed to show it, but Playboy promoted a patriarchal world in which Barbie doll-like women were transformed into hairless, glistening, plumped-up ideals, shaped not by their own desires, but by those of men. When Hefner commissioned a hit piece on the feminist movement in 1970, he told his staff, "These chicks are our natural enemy." Hef claimed to love women, said Jill Filipovich in Time.com, but he viewed us as objects without minds or souls and promoted our freedom only insofar as it benefited men's sex lives, in particular his own, rather than challenging the notion that sex is primarily about male pleasure and experience, he magnified it. Hefner leaves a coarser, degraded culture as his principal legacy, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. He launched Playboy with talk of jazz and Picasso, but ended up as a lecherous, lowbrow Peter Pan, a leering grotesque with a paid harem of fame-seeking women several decades his junior. The social liberalism Hef championed paved the way for the rot of ubiquitous, misogyny-laced internet porn and for the conservatives unashamedly voting in a playboy as our president. That, too, is Hef's legacy. Mr. Hefner passed away last week at the age of 91. And we'll finish with a quote from Larry David. He says, "I don't like to be out of my comfort zone, which is about a half inch wide." With that, we have to end it. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.